One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
From Postcard from the Past and the award-winning Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is a place where we investigate old picture postcards, their messages and their images as they take us from banality to heartbreak, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. And we attempt to understand what it is that causes us to keep hold of these little cardboard rectangles. Each time, I welcome two guests, and it's their postcards that act as small clues to direct us towards memories, mysteries, and stories. I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm delighted to say that today my guests are biographer James Hogg and novelist Richard Smith. Richard and James, welcome to Podcast from the Past.
Hello. Thank you. Hi.
Now, if you are interested in the history and characters of show business, you may well have read a book by James Hogg. He is in part, or wholly, responsible for biographies of James Robertson Justice, Ernie Wise, Kenny Everett, Richard Briers, Bernard Cribbins. This is a pantheon of popular entertainment.
Mm. Well, Bernard was a collaboration between Bernard and myself. So I helped him write his autobiography.
Ah, even better.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a lot of fun.
I'm sure it was a pleasure to work with.
Yeah, he was.
Well, we had to say it to some extent, but...
Of course, we actually had a Jack and Ori chair, believe it or not, in his living room. And the first day we started doing the interviews, we sat there, I turned my dictaphone on, and he actually said, "My name's Bernard Cribbins, and I suppose you'd like me to tell you a story," or something along those lines. And every single hair on my body sort of, leapt to its feet, and it was sort of, that was amazing. So, we had some fun with that.
Yeah, I suppose working with a storyteller or someone who likes telling stories is a good start.
It is. I actually did two books with Brian Blessed before that in exactly the same sort of capacity, which was slightly more profane than working with Bernard, louder, and a little bit more raucous. But it's how I like to do it. I do ghost sometimes, but I much prefer collaborating. With people who can just helping them to get the words out and put them in the right order.
Very good, very good. That is that's important work.
Yeah, very much. Oh, national importance, definitely.
Importance for us readers, anyway.
Yeah,
now, definitely. James joins us today bearing a YO11 postmark. What is that?
It's Scarborough, Scarbados. I absolutely love it there. It's the place that I could quite happily, the only other place apart from Monte Carlo, obviously, where I could happily reside. We bought a static there when our children were very small and had 10 years closer there, and it was heavenly. It really, really was. So it's a very special place, Scarbados.
And you didn't feel it was too much of an obligation if you got that place, you had to go there? Or
kind of. We wanted to, though. And so it's Friday afternoon, chuck the kids and everything in the car and go up there for the weekend, and then a few weeks during the summer. And then a few years ago, the kids sort of said, "I don't want to go to Scarborough anymore." So we're like, "Oh, right, okay, fair enough.
We've done that."
So we've done that. So we got rid of it and bought a place in France instead. And they've already got rid of that. Oh, sorry, got bored of that. So it's like, right, okay, go off and do your own thing. We don't care anymore.
Very good. Well, yeah, when you get rid of the place in France and get the place in the Caribbean, let me know.
I will. Absolutely. I'm working on it.
Now, when you're in France or Scarborough or anywhere else, do you still send postcards, James?
Very occasionally. I collect them more than send them. So I have a collection probably only of about 200. But I love... Phil May, primarily, who's one of the postcards
we'll come to that.
We'll come to that. But yeah, I collect postcards.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's going to be very interesting. Good. Now, Richard Smith is a journalist with a particular interest in natural history. He's also a crossword compiler, but I think he's become best known in the last few years as the author of The Woodcock, an extremely well-received novel that takes the reader into a seething rock pool of crabs and sea slugs and ragworms and faith and fairgrounds in a windswept northeastern coastal town between the wars. Richard comes to us today with a WF postmark. Where's that?
It's Wakefield, where I was born, where I grew up. And yes, yeah, the place that's left a mark on me, not least in my accent, which may not be apparent to anyone who's not Northern, but the Wakefield accent is quite distinctive, largely because it's only got one vowel. It's a bit like a Hull accent, but it's lazier, if you can imagine such a thing. So I wasn't sure whether to say WF1, which is the city, or WF4, which is the fairly, relatively leafy suburb in which I grew up. But one way or the other, it's WF. WF is where I'm from.
And you still have connections there?
Yeah, my mum and dad still live in the house I grew up in. And obviously I've got small kids, so we're always over there angling for babysitting whenever possible. And it's the kind of city that hasn't changed that much in, well, I'm 44 now, it hasn't really changed that much over 40 years. And yeah, we only live an hour away, so I'll never quite leave it behind.
No, whether you want to or not.
Exactly, yeah, that's hometowns for you.
Exactly. And Richard, when did you last send a postcard?
It's a good question. I do tend to send one to my mum, but that's about it. And they send postcards to us. When I was invited to do this, I initially thought, well, I don't really send that many postcards. I don't get that many postcards. But then I started to think about it, and it turns out they're everywhere. Right. So I don't send them that much. I'll send one or two if I go away on holiday, maybe. But then I collect them from, you know, you pick them up from art galleries, yeah. You pick them up in bookshops, you pick them up from exhibitions, all kinds of different things. So it turns out I have got quite a few dozen lying about the place.
Yeah. I think they are more ubiquitous than people realise, partly because I think a lot of the acquisition of them is almost unconscious.
Absolutely. That's right. They're just there's sort of in that sweet spot between small enough to pick up without barely registering it, but large enough and significant enough to be kept, to be treasured.
Yeah, well, I always say the thing is, paper is pretty resilient, paper or card.
That's very true, yeah.
So unless you actually set fire to them or put them in a bucket of water, they're going to stay there. They're not. You know,
that's
not
a good
going
point,
anywhere.
Actually, yeah.
And it's the same.
And they can vanish. They get folded into books. They get at the bottom of wardrobes or cupboards. They can vanish for years.
Yeah.
And reappear in postcards. That's one of the magic of them.
Yeah, I find, and I've got far, far too many cards everywhere, but I find I can lose them very, very easily and drive myself crazy trying to find them again, you know, just by looking in the wrong place. But anyway. All right, before we hear about the cards that both Richard and James have prepared for today, a quick one of mine. And this is a postcard from the past postcard, like I do on Twitter in my book. It's an old card, and I'll just select a bit of the message. So this is a card of Inverary in Scotland. And I've got it in front of me. Richard and James have it. They've got a document, so they can see it as well. And it's a street scene looking out onto the bay with a ridiculously sort of fluffy clouds. Very unconvincing, really. But the message is, well, it was sent in 1971 to Cheadle Hume in Cheshire from someone called Tricia. Sent to Rachel, actually, Rachel Fisher. And she says, "Dear Rachel, we're having a lovely holiday, but we're not staying in Inverary. I went and bought the wrong card. We're staying in Oban, actually, and this looks rather like it, so I went and bought it. Sorry." So it's a message about being the wrong message. I don't know. So something
brilliant.
Self-destructive about the way that functions. I'll do another quick one. This is and this would probably appeal to both of you actually, Bridlington. And it's a Dennis postcard. Dennis, one of the biggest and oldest postcard publishers. 1989, 24th of October, since you ask. And it was sent to Ian Walker, Walner, who was staff at the Windermere Hotel, Windermere. And I know he's staff because he's got his staff in brackets. I wonder if staff cards maybe went to a different postbox from cards going to residents. I don't know. And it's a nice picture of Bridlington along the promenade. A lot of sand at Bridlington. It reminds me of, you know, how much sand there is there. It's a nice beach, actually. Anyway, this struck me as a sort of melancholy message, really. He says, "We've had a lovely holiday here in Brid, but alas, every good thing comes to an end. We're on our way home today." And here's the bit that pierced my heart. It says, "Hope to see you soon. I seem to be always saying it." And I thought, yeah, we do all say that a lot.
Yeah, that's very true, actually.
And you find, you say it and the last thing you said to that person was the same thing and you still haven't seen them. So it's like Christmas cards, you know, we must get together next year.
Yeah.
There's something melancholy about that. I mean, it's nice. It's nicer to be in touch than not to be in touch. But anyway, I should let you know, at home, you'll be able to see images of the sands at Bridlington and Inverary looking like Oban and all the other pictures. They're all going to be on the show notes, which is postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can see that we're not making it up. This is all real stuff. Now, Richard and James out in cyberspace, you've been kind enough to dig out some cards for this recording. Let's start with you, James. I think I understand you're already breaking various rules with this by doing multiple cards, but let's...
yes.
Mind you, I don't know where you're going to start. But let's start with the first card that you've got for us. Is it the black and white one?
It's the black and white... The two together.
Ah, the two together, right, OK.
I can start with Romano's, if you like.
Whatever works for you. You have a sense of narrative, so you tell me.
I'll start with Romano's. Okay. Romano's was... Not much of a story behind it, in the sense that when I was 17, I moved to London, ran away literally, and managed to get a job in theatre, just sort of selling ice creams and then box office at the at Wyndham's Theatre on Charing Cross Road. And I became fascinated with the sort of the West End of the 20s and 30s, you know, the Aldwych farces and the Strand, basically. And I became a day member of a club called, a private members club called the Green Room, just off the Strand, which is where all the old actors like Ballard, Berkeley and all that used to go and sort of, you know, drink port and fall asleep in the afternoon. And they used to let sort of people like me join during the day, you know, young people who worked in theatre, etc. And I used to go there. And there was this restaurant called Romano's, which was open until about 1915, 1920. And it's where everybody went. And the address was number 400, the Strand.
Wow.
And it's in... Oh, however many or hundreds of autobiographies. I think one, an actor called Henry Kendall, who died in the 60s, even called his autobiography "I Remember Romano's," and it's all the Gaiety. It's all the Gaiety Theatre. It sort of evokes a period in the West End that I genuinely do find absolutely fascinating.
Well, before you go any further, I think we've got to describe this, because this is a hell of a picture.
It's beautiful.
Tell the listener, because this doesn't look like an ordinary restaurant.
No, it was the outside, the frontage. It's like a shop. It's like a small shop, and so it's sort of TARDIS-esque, really. You come in, and I don't know how you describe the decoration, but it's like the inside of a palace.
It's like the Alhambra or something, isn't it?
Yeah, the Alhambra. It's astonishing. And it's
a ballroom size. This is the size.
It's ballroom size. But anybody who was anybody went there for, I think, about 40, 50 years. It was open. And the tales, the stories are legion. And it's one of those places that, of many places, that are no longer with us, that if I had that time machine, that would be the first button I would press.
Saturday night, Friday night?
Oh, any night, honestly, any night. Lunch, apparently lunch there was very, very good.
And I even bought
the other day, there is a link between one of the other postcards. The chap who drew that, Phil May, was the regular in this place. And and he used to do sketches of his friends leaving.
Right.
So as they were sort of like, you know, hobbling away in an advanced state of refreshment, he would sketch them and then send them the sketch afterwards. It's just an astonishing place. And I used to just stand outside number 400, the Strand, just gazing, just sort of, you know, trying to bring it to life.
And when you were doing that, what was that 400, the Strand? Because I believe 399 is Stanley Gibbons.
That's right, 399 to 400, but the official address was 400.
So is it where Stanley Gibbons is?
I'm not sure. I think so. It must be the same building. I don't think it's there anymore. I think the building is now gone.
Yeah, because Stanley Gibbons isn't that big.
No, exactly. So it must have been one of those
little alcoves.
But exactly. So look at it. The inside of the place is just it's stupendous. And obviously you've got the band at the back. So you'd have had, I don't know, whoever. It could have been Jack Hilton or somewhere like that. I mean, the West End was probably teeming with these places back in the day. But the only one that I've really got to know, obviously through reputation, more than anything, obviously, is Romano's.
And who was Romano?
Romano was obviously an Italian gentleman. And let me just see. I was looking at the fantastic Arthur Lloyd website about this earlier, which brings to life all that sort of stuff. Here we go. There was even a book written about it. It was Ghosts and Grease Paint by a guy called W. McQueen Pope in 1951, Romano's Restaurant.
He wrote a lot about the Edwardian thing, didn't he?
Yeah, I've got all of his books, you know. I'm a big fan. But an Italian gentleman who arrived, I think, about 1914 was when it was at its height.
Wow. Well, yeah. He certainly made a go of it.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Have you got any menus from there in your interest?
No, but I've got it as a saved thing on eBay. So whenever something comes up about Romano's anywhere on the sale room, there are various things. If anything comes up anywhere in an auction house, on eBay, I know about it immediately. And then I start selling things to pay for whatever it is, children, you know, yeah, exactly, wives, you know, whatever, doesn't matter.
So you go there late at night in your dreams?
Yeah, I genuinely do. I have dreamt about that place. And because I've read so many accounts about what it was like, I have been able to build up a picture in my mind, if you know what I mean. So, all the people, all the Aldwych farceurs like Ralph Lynn and Robertson Hare and all those sorts of Mary Brough going there and, you know, and contemporaries of theirs, I suppose. But, you know, and then going back to the Phil Mays of this world and, all the people. I'm actually a member of a club in London called the Savile. And there's a lot of connections between that place and Romano's, and a lot of people I know I've met at the Savile know people who went to Romano's. So it's building up all these sort of links, which is incredible.
You've got the right job, haven't you? Because you really like finding this stuff out.
Yeah, I'm very nosy. You have to be very nosy in our line of work. You really do. But it's fantastic. So it's when I was doing the James Robertson Justice book. You know, I spent sort of four weeks on a grouse moor in Scotland. He was a big hunter, and I was up there, and managed to find the cairn where his remains were buried, and all these sorts of things. But it's finding out this sort of stuff. I'm fascinated. Being fascinated by something to this sort of degree is a great gift. It really is because it consumes you, but in the most fantastic way. And when you find out little bits like, and when you're able to talk about it without, you know, you give us 10 minutes until we bore you stupid. But it's tremendous. Ovaltine, was it Kenny Everett used to call, was it Ovaltine for the ears? I suppose it's Ovaltine for the mind. This is, it really is.
Yeah. No, I think it's always fascinating to find out about things that were hugely popular or hugely influential that are almost forgotten.
Yes, indeed. And we're flying the flag and clinging on to the memory, for dear life, I suppose.
And just one last question about this postcard. Do you think it's a promotional card? Is it, or is it just a souvenir?
I think it was probably a souvenir because back in the day they were so popular, these places, and they were, you know, there was no you had newspapers, you didn't have radio, you know, your newspapers and word of mouth. So to have some, wow, Romano's, blah, blah goes there, blah, blah goes there. So you get a souvenir, and it would have meant a lot to a lot of people. Whereas obviously now it only really means something to a bit of a weirdo like me. But yeah, back in, you know, it would have meant something. It would have been, yeah, the same as a souvenir postcard, Tower Bridge or whatever, Romano's restaurant. Wow.
Right. Part of that West End scene.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
And of course, just down the road from, what was it, the Strand Palace Hotel?
That's right. And the Aldwych Theatre, which is the one that's where, you know, all the farces, all the Ben Travers stuff took place, which...
Perhaps people were sort of hiding behind the doors in Romano's and popping out at inadvertent moments.
Possibly. No. Or stumbling out, I should think. But, exactly.
Very indeed. Good. Well, thank you for our brief dinner date at Romano's. That was very, yes, very interesting.
Very enjoyable.
Richard, what's the first card on your doormat?
Well, I hesitate to trample on James's territory, but I've got the water splash at Scarborough.
Oh, excellent. This is
the way we planned it. It's perfect.
Oh. So this is, I don't know why I have this postcard. I found it in one of my many boxes of stuff. No one sent it to me. I must have bought it myself, but it depicts a landmark of Old Scarborough that's no longer with us.
It's the water splash. Looking place.
It is. It's on the end of the South Bay at Scarborough. It's sort of on a hill, and it's a water park. I mean, it wouldn't be unusual nowadays. It's just bright blue, two twining water slides going down into the main pool, and. When I was, it was bright blue, so it's visible for miles from the other side of the town. And when I was a kid, this was heaven. This was the this was Mecca. This was it just defined what Scarborough was all about. And it's interesting to me because like James, I love Scarborough. I grew up in Wakefield, which is about as far from the sea as you can get in the north of England. It's right in the middle. And so we had the classic 2-week August holiday, and it was always, nearly always, on the east coast. So that sort of magic zone between Bridlington and Whitby was our playground for 2 weeks every August. And Scarborough, whether we stayed in Scarborough or stayed in Filey or Robinhood's Bay or Whitby or Brid, Scarborough was the epicentre. Scarborough was the place we had to go.
It was the original to some extent, I think, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was one of those very early, yeah. Exactly, one of those first elegant seaside resorts that were opened up by the railways. And it's interesting to me because, well, I'm fascinated by coasts generally, and the Yorkshire coast in particular, because of the... It's not. I mean, Scarborough the town is just a town. You can go there and you could walk about and not feel like you're in anywhere more special than any other northern town. But Scarborough seafront is a different matter.
Right.
Because seafront's a place of entertainment for the people who visit, if not for the people who live there, they're in a constant state of transformation, a constant state of flux, because entertainment changes, fashion changes, and the
novelty. Place... They need novelty.
Exactly. It's always a new novelty. It always has to be something new. And well, in the case of the North Yorkshire coast, it's transforming physically because it's falling apart, and has been since I was a kid. It's eroding dramatically. So I go and look at, we used to stay in a holiday house in Filey, and it's just not there anymore because it was right on the cliff edge.
Destroying your memories.
Exactly. But it's, so they're also changing in this very obvious way, and you can see it when you're there because they're there. They don't change overnight. You still have the remnants of the elegant, 1920s, 1930s, particularly in the posh end down in the South Bay. And then you go to the middle bit, which is where Corrigan's Arcade is and the Silver Dollar Arcade, and you can hear the clank and the clang of the arcade machines and smell of things frying. And that's the Scarborough I grew up with. That's the Scarborough I know. And it's changing still, you know, as new things move in. The water splash was taken down years ago. It was replaced briefly by a paintball
It was awful, that place.
Yeah. It was, yeah, it was grim.
It was.
You could have paintball anywhere. Yeah, paintball. Yeah, I don't know why. You don't need to be at the seaside for that.
No, it was very barren and sort of bleak.
Isn't there supposed to be a cinema being built there or something like that?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, and there's now a... If you want to get your water slide fix, you have to go a little bit out, more inland. There's a big fancy new water place. Exactly, very good. Yeah. Which is lovely, I should say.
Yeah.
Did you go on the slide when you had the chance, Richard?
Oh, goodness me, yeah, of course.
You were allowed to.
Spent all the time I could in there.
Can't, or...
Oh, no. No, it was great. And that whole corner of Scarborough. It is, it's fantastic. It's better than the nonsense you get nowadays. I'm such an old man. No, it was great. There was nothing that wasn't great about water splash when you're 8 years old and you're on your summer holidays. But it's funny because it is obviously also a big plastic monstrosity, you know, depending on how you look at it. I remember not long before my granny died, which was a good few years ago now, but she always used to come on holiday with us. It was always me, my mum and dad, my brother, my granny and granddad, and my auntie. And Scarborough was always really special to all of them as well. But that corner of Scarborough, because, as I said, it's gone through these changes, there's this little sort of setup of apartments and a shop and a cafe there now. But we drove past when that had just been built, and my granny was in the back of the car. She remembered, I think she remembered like a lion's tea room what you call them, beach huts. Wow. And just a more, I can't say more elegant, because it was just the same sort of thing, but of a different time.
Yeah.
And she was really upset. I think she just wasn't ready for how much it had changed. But of course, that's what these places do.
But at the same time, it's quite intrusive. I mean, you're right. It is an eyesore. If you're not having fun on it, it could even be an industrial set. Couldn't it?
It could absolutely. Concrete plant. Paint it grey. Yeah, exactly. paint it battleship grey. Yeah, you've got some kind of industrial installation. But the thing is about these places, even though they do change so quickly and so profoundly, at the same time, they're the places that have the greatest impact on memory. I mean, there's. Yes. Nowhere to me is as vivid as just if you just turn left at the water park, you go past a place called P-Zone Park.
Oh, yes. Is that where they had the battles?
It was, yeah. They used to have the battleships on the pond. And they used to have a tree, still do, I think, have a tree walk. And it used to be when it turned dusk, they'd have light bulbs strung up through the trees, when I was 7 or 8, that was just the most magical. So even the word P-Zone Park, even though for the entirety of my childhood, I thought it was called P-Zone Park, as in the P-Zone.
The zone for the P's.
Yeah, the zone of the P's.
Did you ever see the organ? They still have it, the little stage in the middle of the pond, and they have the organist playing in there. And
well, no, I never did.
People, yeah, we were there a few years ago, and they were still doing it. So you get all the pensioners to sit around there with their flasks and sandwiches, and somebody on, you know, sort of like a mobile floating Wurlitzer would knock out the hits.
Oh, I love stuff like that. And like I say, you can still see particularly down at the other end of the bay, you can see all that where the pavilion used to be. And
I think there's
many promises of refurbishment and relaunch, but, you know, where they used to have the Ted Heath Orchestra and Max Jaffa and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, Max Jaffa was the sort of fixture, wasn't he, at Scarborough?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the Grand Hotel is still there.
Yeah, just.
Yeah, just clinging on to the cliffside, yeah.
We are very much in danger here of drifting into that terrible place, which is called nostalgia.
God forbid.
This card has had—is it a bad scan or has it had a lot of daylight on it?
It's a little bit. It should be a decent picture, but it's a bit creased and crumpled. And I honestly don't know where it's been because I don't know where it came from. But I was so delighted when I found it.
It's contemporaneous with you going there. You think? Isn't
I
it?
Think so. Yeah. It's old. It's certainly not a. Not an up-to-date one. You can tell by the quality of the picture.
Perhaps and you were the meant car, to write a message on it and you never did.
Maybe. It's a strange thing for me to hold on to, and I'm really, really glad I did. Because there's two landmarks of Scarborough. There's that and there's the castle. And the castle's still standing. And the water splash, despite being much younger, is long gone.
Very good. Well, look, I'm thrilled to see. As you say, it could be something out of some kind of precious metals mine or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, those photographs by, is it Salgado? Anyway, perhaps it doesn't apply to anyone else. Well, that's very good. I'll just by a strange coincidence, I'll do one more quick card of mine, and it's a card of Scarborough. There you go. We really have planned this show. This is a multi-view, and it's meaning there's more than one picture, and it's a sepia card of Scarborough, and it's got four elements, which are Children's Corner, South Bay, North Bay, sort of at dusk, I think, or twilight, the Corner Cafe on the North Bay, and the Children's Yachting Pool in the P Zone. it's got a Scarborough postmark from 1931, actually, so it goes back a while. Sent to Widnes in Lancashire, and it's from someone. I think their initials. I think it's J.S. Ramskill. I don't think they obviously don't know them that well. Perhaps they're neighbours, as opposed to, you know, close relatives. Anyway, the only bit that intrigues is I'm having quite a decent time up here. I wish Albert was here for a good game of tennis. Hope you're both okay. Cheerio. So I don't know who Albert is, but he would have obviously enjoyed playing tennis at Scarborough.
I can tell you, if you hold up my card next to that bottom left picture of Corner Cafe in the North Bay, that follows exactly. So that Corner Cafe was the one that my granny was.
That's the one. That's the Lions Tea House.
For the loss of, and if you go left of that, that's where Water Splash was. Not obviously 1931, but that's how the geography lines up.
There you are, listeners. If you align one to the other, slowly, piece by piece, we will build a full map of Scarborough through the ages.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard Podcast, and my guests today are James Hogg and Richard Smith. Well, it's a surprise. We've received a postcard. And here it is. It's from Jeanette Tighe, T-I-G-H-E. I never know how to pronounce that word. Tighe. And Jeanette says, answer number one, Hickory Dickory Dock. Answer number two, Sir Francis Drake. Well, I'm sorry, Jeanette, they're the wrong answers. On with the postcard stories. James, what's the second card you've got for us today? Now, this is where we get into your Phil May interest, I think.
Yes, well, it starts off with the caricature of Benjamin Britten on the left.
Oh, I think that's Benjamin
Britten. The left
Britten.
Of the two. It is. There was years ago, I've always loved those sorts of caricatures, the kind of things you used to get in Tatler and magazines like that every month. And there was one particular favourite of mine, a guy called Fred May. And he's quite well known within the industry, if you like. But he was with the Tatler. He was the guy who did all their cartoons from, I think, 1920 until about 1976 when he died. And my wont, I started researching him, and I managed to found out that his son, who was actually called Phil May, still is.
But and he lived otherwise, in a place, there's no connection with the Mays, is it?
There's no connection right. with them at all. And he lived in a place called West Witten. And I'm from Midlam in the Dales, the Yorkshire Dales. And right. West Witten, it's like 3 miles away. And I thought, well, that's weird. And my grandparents lived there, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I looked at the article and I thought, well, if he's still alive, he'd be about 94. But I managed to track him down. I'd like track down a number. And I thought, well, he's probably dead. He probably is long, long dead. And I left a message just saying, look, you know, if this is Phil May, huge fan of your father, I collect his work. You know, if you have anything you'd like to sell me, it'd be lovely to have a chat, blah, 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 just on the off chance.
You're not shy, are you?
No. Was it Shy Burns getting out or whatever?
But, oh my God.
And he rang me back, 94 wow. years old. And this is so, so strange. I went to visit him and he said, this is my address in West Witten. I was like, that can't be. No, he must have got that wrong. And I got there and it wasn't. He lived directly next door to my grandparents and knew them, actually knew my grandparents. So I had actually met him, but he knew my grandparents.
Amazing.
It was the most astonishing. So, we're still really good friends. He's now in a nursing home. He's getting on for a ton.
Yeah.
And he just sends me, he finds these little works of his dad's and says, oh, he did this, have this.
Oh.
And it's astonishing. And I'm at the moment compiling a Wikipedia page for him because he's sort of forgotten about, but he shouldn't be because was, you know, he was the only person who did a cartoon of Churchill that Churchill took to and actually signed. He's the only one he ever signed that he enjoyed. And it's on display somewhere in York, at a museum in York. And I've actually got a print of it, but with one of with a signature by Churchill. So I've got everything that's available that Fred May did. It's fantastic. So, but anyway, so he's called Phil himself, his son. He's also an illustrator. He does sort of cars and wartime, ancient cars and wartime aircraft, you know, from the First, Second World War. Quite eminent, quite well known. And he said, you know, there's a much more famous Phil May. And he put me on to Phil May, the apparently very, very well-known caricaturist who died in about 1903, who was born in Leeds, where I live. And so all of a sudden, who was a regular at Romano's, and all of a sudden, this world sort of
you're starting to populate
up.
Your restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely, indeed. And Phil May is
booking for May.
Booking for May and or Hog, and Phil. I asked him about the caricature is Phil May, and he said, oh, I've got some books by him and etc. And it's again, it's opened up. I've always been a fan of that sort of work, whether it be the stuff that the slightly more, I suppose, basic stuff that black and white that film that Fred May does, or the slightly more colourful sort of modern day cartoons that Phil May.
So we should describe the Phil May postcard in front of us.
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead.
Indeed. So it's let me see the. They're usually Shakespearean quotes, so he'll have something, because it was all Victorian, so it's how sour sweet music is when time is, it says, broke and no proportion left. I think that's what it says, Richard the Second. And obviously
rather a dry caption for a cartoon, isn't it?
Slightly.
I'd give that another go, Phil.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. But he did hundreds of these things. And because he was a huge celebrity of the day, if he was out in a restaurant, Romano's or wherever, people would, the great and the good, would send over £2 notes or 2 fivers, these huge things, ask him to do an illustration on one, keep that, and send that back to them, and he would keep the other. And he made an absolute fortune doing that. Spent it all in Romano's, etc. He was a real bon viveur. But it was Fred May. I love Phil May. Phil May stuff is wonderful. But Fred May is always has been, always will be my real favourite. I love that sort of that sort of stuff. And, you know, with the slightly larger head.
It's quite a grotesque style. I mean, there's no reflection on Benjamin Britten. It's not pretty, his way of doing things, is it?
No, but it was extremely popular. Yeah, very angular. It was extremely popular in the, you know, the 1920s, 1930s. Very, very popular. Obviously, not now. And it was lovely meeting. It was, you know, I actually befriended this guy's son. Yeah, you know, all my friends are all my friends in their sort of 80s and 90s, popping off all the time. I've got to get somebody, you know, below 70.
Yeah, I've heard of people hanging around elderly widows. I don't know if this is a similar game.
I choose cartoonists instead. Right. Yeah, illustrators and cartoonists.
Talking of wealthy people, I think Phil May, the Edwardian illustrator.
Yes.
He was so incredibly successful.
Yeah, he was.
Because,
my
interpretation of it, illustrators could be really successful and important people because you didn't really have photographic reproduction in magazines.
No.
But you did have a sort of burgeoning print media that was really hungry for good illustrations that could capture some kind of humanity. And he obviously had such a facility for it. And as you say, he could knock them out and work do a huge amount of work.
Yeah,
I think he made a fortune.
He did make a fortune. He died penniless because he was a bit of a soak, and he had a lot of hangers on. So you know, everybody would be, you know, Phil was the one. Oh, don't worry, Phil will pay. And sure enough, Phil did pay, and he died in, I think he was 1903. He was only 39.
He died young, didn't he? But I think they were like stars. I think in a way we can't imagine illustrators being like stars. I don't think
that. No, but you hit the nail on the head. As I said, if nowadays if you're out and you see somebody famous in a restaurant, you sort of surreptitiously get your iPhone out or whatever. And you take a photograph. Whereas, you know, what you did in those days, good Lord, it's Phil May. I'll send over two fibres, you know, illustrate one, send it back to me, keep the other. I think that's a much better way of doing things.
And I'm not an expert on Phil May at all, but the only other thing my other little reflection, for what it's worth, is that a lot of these illustrators at that time, as I say, they were stars. They were almost pop stars. They were very clubbable. So they would hang out at Romano's, and they'd hang out at the Savage Club, or they'd hang out. In a way, I don't know that illustrators nowadays, they probably sit at home doing their work, but I think they were more like your Damien Hirst in the 90s.
You know. I think you could probably say that about composers, actors, etc., similar sort of thing. You know, all the old clubs, etc., the ones like the Garrick. I was talking to somebody who's a member there the other day, and he said that 50 years ago you only got actors and the like in there. He said nowadays, you know, they've got to open it up to barristers or whatever, because, you know, the actors are sort of at home drinking, I don't know, green tea or whatever, you know, reading and being well behaved. But yeah, everybody's taking their pleasure in different ways these days.
Yeah, I don't know how these people found time to do the work. I suppose you had to be a genius. You had to be someone who could just bang it out.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, as you said, that was all there was at the time, which is why these people were so increased. You know, the demand was there. So I suppose if you've got the demand and you've got the adoration, etc., and you've got the cash, it charges you on. Yeah. You get on with it.
Very interesting. It's actually an area of postcards which we've not really lifted the lid on much in this podcast over however many episodes it is. Is the sort of the world of Edwardian illustrators. And well, you know, thank you for opening up Phil May, and then by the other Phil May, our other May.
Fred, Phil, and Phil.
Oh my God. Well, if you didn't want to confuse me, you've still managed it. So.
Get in there.
Let's head to something nice and simple. So, Richard, what's the final card you've got for us?
So my other card is something I picked up when I was in Budapest a few years ago, and it's a picture of some coffee grinders that's been sitting on my desk ever since I got hold of it.
That's a good place to keep a card.
It is. It takes pride of place, only behind the picture of my wife and children, I should add. But it depicts 16 vintage-looking coffee grinders with the top handle. And it says at the top, coffee grinders. And above that, it says it in Hungarian, which I believe is Kave Daralok. My Hungarian, I don't speak any Hungarian, but... it's evocative to me of a lot of different things. Most obviously, it's evocative of coffee, which I'm a full-bore coffee wanker. Before I had kids, I had a coffee grinder exactly like one of these. Obviously, now I have small children, and therefore I have no time to grind my own coffee, and I have to drink pre-ground coffee like a wild animal, which is nowhere to live. And so, I guess I've always been fascinated by Budapest and by Hungary, and in a quite a strange way. And it also ties in with my feelings about travel generally and the experience of foreign places. So one thing that I love about Budapest particularly is that it's got great cafes. It's got a great cafe culture, and it's got a great historic cafe culture. And I'm speaking here about Hungary as if I'm a authority when I've been for one city break there a few years ago.
Many people would have got a 5-page article out of it. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is relevant because I think it says something about how we experience cities, or how I experience cities anyway. One of the reasons I love the cafe culture in Budapest is, but obviously they do good coffee and they do good cake and they have shadowy corners and they have grand sort of Austro-Hungarian fittings and lovely waiting staff. But also it's because I've read about places like that my whole life in the kinds of novels and short stories I've read. I mean, one of my favourite short stories is by a guy called Andrei Eddy, and it's called Ten Florence Bridegroom. And it's just the most classic, I don't know what the Hungarian equivalent of Grub Street is, but it's the classic account of the struggling hack doing the rounds of the coffee shops, it's called Ten Florence Bridegroom because he gets 10 florins for his stories, and he's just constantly trying to sell the next story. And apart from the insane fantasy of a man making a living by selling short stories, which is would be a lovely fantasy land to live in, sadly not viable in the present day. It's just such a beautiful vision of a world that I would have loved to live in. And what's interesting to me is that I don't know what it was really like, and I don't care. Budapest is a place that, for me, like a lot of places in the world, exists as a fantasy. And I don't want to be sort of to exoticize it in that way, because I know it is obviously it's a real place and it's got real people and it's got real life and
real problems.
A lot going, real problems. Yeah, absolutely. Particularly politically at the moment. But for me, I've always experienced foreign places more completely in fiction and in history than in person. I'm a terrible traveller.
Oh, really?
I can never go off the beaten track because I'd get too nervous. I like to see places. I'm the classic, was it Oscar Wilde? Who was it who said about the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland, which is worth seeing but not worth going to see, which is a kind of a meaningless thing to say, but it often comes to my mind when I think about places that, you know, I'd like to have seen, but whether I want to go and see them is a different matter.
Yeah.
So
it's a sort of getting up off your sofa kind of thing, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Once you're there, you love it. But
exactly. But will they live up to? How do they compare to the places, to the Budapest, the Moscow, the New York that I've read about my whole life, that I've thought about my whole life?
But don't you find when you go somewhere that the real place, you overlay the pre-existing kind of literature, they don't really match. So there's always something new and different when you're there, because...
Oh, absolutely, there is, yeah. But that's
one
interesting.
One is the shape of your brain and one is the shape of a city.
That's true, yeah. You walk in this sort of palimpsest sort of thing. I mean, yeah, overlay is a very good way of putting it, like a transparency laid over it. But I also don't quite like that, because I like to see places as they are, and I don't like to live in a lot of people do like to live out a fantasy, but I don't. So in my head, when I go to these places, I tend to compartmentalize them. There's the real one, and there's there's the one I've explored in other ways.
They both exist, but they're just different.
Exactly. And
so when you go to a city, here's how I think is what makes me, this is my reflection. So you go to Paris, Do you read a book set in Paris while you're in Paris, or do you deliberately choose something that isn't because there's a sort of weird out-of-registerness about it?
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. I have done that sometimes, but I don't feel... First of all, it makes me frustrated because I want to... You can experience a city, unless you live there and or spend many years there or, you know, come to know it really well. You experience places through art and through you know, more abstract ways. You experience it, I can't say more, you can't say better, and I can't say more realistically, but often more powerfully. I mean, you have a weekend in a great city, you're not really going to, it's very unlikely to have to make a very profound impression on you in the same way that a great novel about that city would, in my view anyway. Maybe that's just how I absorb places. Wow. And information.
City break and the death of travel.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying.
Well, that's nice to know. Nice to know I'm not completely mad.
But I don't know if Budapest, I agree with it, but I get it.
Budapest is an interesting place in particular because Hungary, of which Budapest has historically been such a, you know, overwhelming part, very much defined by its capital in so many ways, has always been about exile. And I'm fascinated by that as well. I'm fascinated about the idea that this country has in so many ways been characterised by people who were no longer there.
Right.
So this is going to be a digression on Hungarians, if that's all right.
Looking forward to it.
There's a concept. So it started as a joke, and obviously it is a joke, but it's not a meaningless joke, about how the Hungarians... because in the sort of 1930s, there's a huge influx of Hungarian scientists to America, largely through persecution at home, and they were the mainspring of the Manhattan Project.
Right.
To build the nuclear weapon. And the joke that did the rounds was that it was Enrico Fermi, the Italian physicist, had this proposition about intelligent life and super intelligent beings, and where were they? That they must exist. The probability is that they must exist. And the joke was, they do exist. They live among us, but they call themselves Hungarians because the Hungarians who worked on the Manhattan Project were so insanely brilliant.
Right.
They appeared to have, you know, they were scattered from their homeland.
Yes.
They spoke a language that had no connection to any other language. Hungarian is a unique language. I believe it has some connections with Finnish. And so this joke was that they were the Martians. And there's a lovely line where this proposition was put to Edward Teller, who was one of these Hungarians, and he said he looked worried and said, "Von Karman must have been talking," which is great. So you've got these incredible guys. Who are, you know, changing the world, and they're doing it as exiles.
Yes.
And Hungarians in film as well, in mathematics.
Yeah, the British film industry at one point was
absolutely
run by Hungarians, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Michael Curtis and so on. And it's just interesting to me that this, that we come to know a country so thoroughly through its exiles,
yes.
And so I'm fascinated by Hungary for that reason. That's another reason why these coffee grinders rather sit on my desktop.
And they have a Grand Prix as well, which is...
Which is
super. And I think it was also where the first ever stadium concert took place behind the Iron Curtain.
Was it?
Yeah, it was Queen in 1986.
Was it?
The first ever,
Mind you, they'd play anywhere.
Yeah, I was going to say they had fun for that, didn't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was known as the happiest barracks in the Soviet Union. It was because relatively, I mean, apart with...
There's a bit of dry Cold War humour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, obviously they had their moments, but yeah, as a general rule, they were less under, until 1956, obviously, they were less under the hammer than anywhere else. But this sense of a slight sense of unreality about the place comes from the fact that the history is so contested. Their engagement with the war, with fascism back then is still such a live issue. And this again just makes it such a sort of protean place. And I hate to sort of make a real place sound like a I don't know, a parlor game or to somebody's fantasy, because it's obviously so much more than that. But there is certainly something in the understanding of a city like that that is changeable,
I suppose. There's a Budapest and there's a Budapest of the mind, and they're not...
Exactly, yeah.
You know, they overlap, they definitely do.
That's it, yeah.
Well, thank you for grinding away at your understanding of the city and the country and the nature of what visits can and can't do to your understanding. I think that's really interesting. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well, look, thank you both so much for sharing your cards. A very diverse and abstruse selections. I'm delighted. I've said it before, I never know where the cards will send us. Another quick reminder for listeners at home, images of all these cards, from water splashes to coffee grinders to anyone you've ever met, called Brian May, probably. we'll be on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk. And before we let Richard and James off the line, back to reality, I've got one more postcard for you in the Postcard from the Past style. This is a place called, and this is where I'm going to fall over, it's called Grib Goch from Snowdon Summit. So you're at Snowdon and you're looking across somewhere called Grib Goch. I don't know if you... Do you know that place? Am I saying it right?
I'm afraid not.
Well, I must be then.
just say it with confidence, no one will know.
Yeah, you're probably right. 1969, the card says. A nice old one from the Judges, big publisher. Cost fourpence to send the card, actually. And it's one of those Welsh definitives. You've got the Queen there, but with a little dragon at the bottom. It's nice. Sent to Boston in Lincolnshire from someone called Diana. And she's actually sending it to her Auntie Joan, Uncle Charles and Aaron. And she says, Dear Auntie Joan, Uncle Charles and Aaron, I'm having a fantastic time in Wales. The weather is quite decent and I've been swimming, canoeing and climbing. Here, we've had some food poisoning due to a cafe on the beach, but I didn't get it. Love, Diana. So that was a narrow escape.
That's brilliant.
Emotional rollercoaster, that last bit.
Yeah, it was okay. But she's good. She managed to work out where the food poisoning came from. I don't know if the environmental health got there first, but she was there. Right, it's become customary for us to end the show with one of these rather special things. So I don't know if you can... You have a dope sheet in front of you, I think, gentlemen, and you should find a large card with a sort of fairy tale castle on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
Well, there's no mystery here. This is a postcard which is a record, like a gramophone record.
Oh, yeah, you can see it.
Right. Oh, yeah,
you can just see the grooves there, just about. Obviously, you can see the hole for the spindle.
I was thinking that was a huge ball, like in The Prisoner, but I've seen how it's a hole.
Like the ones that were flying down Oxford Street the other day. No, it's a record, and... David in the other room has, I think, digitised it for us. And if we listen very carefully, we should be able to hear what this castle can sound like.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I like it.
So it's the Chateau de Chillon, on Lake Geneva, I think.
Oh, lovely.
Very nice.
And it's got quite a jaunty little tune associated with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I always say the same thing. Oh, maybe our lyrics.
Was it Edmondo Ross or something?
It could be, couldn't it?
Yeah, it sounds like the song.
You tend not to get a proper credit on the back of a cardboard record, so it doesn't say. I think if it was Edmondo Ross, they would tell you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got another story about Edmondo Ross, but I'll tell you that another day. But yeah, it's obviously a medieval castle. And the sound, I think, is pretty good for a piece of cardboard.
It's not bad.
Yeah, sounds all right to me.
Yeah.
This was I think this one's made in Germany. No, made in France. It's one of those ones that wants to put everything in every language, so it's a little bit hard to know where it really comes from. But it says you can have 200 perfect plays of this record. After that, it's absolutely terrible.
It spontaneously combusts. Yeah.
Well, I think we played it once through this recording.
Yeah, so, that's all right, though, isn't it?
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, as the medieval fortress continues to rotate at exactly 45 RPM, that's it for this time on Podcasts from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts. James Hogg and Richard Smith. Thank you both.
Yeah,
thank
thanks,
you.
Tom.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me, at Past Postcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardourstudios.co.uk.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.